Oh, yes, it's Bigler. It's Bigler and it's Bigler's World. For the next hour, we got some newsforkids.net to start out with. It's news just for the kids, okay, just specially tuned to the kids. Got National Geographic, maybe some Ranger Rick. Let's start with this article. Wizard of Oz slippers sell for $28 million. Dallas, Texas. On Saturday, a pair of red shoes worn by Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz was sold at auction for a record-breaking $28 million. That makes the slippers the most expensive movie item ever sold. The sale is the latest chapter in the slippers' complicated history. The classic movie, The Wizard of Oz, was first shown in movie theaters in 1939. In the movie, a young girl named Dorothy, see if you can remember this, gets lost and has an adventure in a magical land. Along the way, she gets a pair of special red ruby slippers. At the end of the movie, Dorothy learns she's able to return home by clicking the heels of her shoes together three times and saying, "There's no place like home." The movie and the ruby slippers are famous around the world. The movie was based on the book The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by Frank L. Baum. In the book, the slippers are silver. The movie makers changed the color of the slippers to red so that the shoes would show up better. During the making of the movie, Ms. Garland used many different pairs of ruby slippers. Some were used for close-ups and others were used for dancing. After the movie was made, the shoes were stored away and forgotten. In the 1970s, someone found and sold the shoes. A man named Michael Shaw bought one pair of the shoes for $2,000. He made money by renting the shoes out. In 2005, he loaned the shoes to the Judy Garland Museum in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, but someone broke into the museum, smashed the glass display case, and stole
the slippers.
The shoes remained missing for 13 years. Then in 2018, the FBI tracked down the slippers. It took five more years to catch the thief, who was in his 70s by that time. The thief had never seen the movie. Police believe that the man thought the shoes had real rubies on them. When he found out they didn't, he got rid of them. Mr. Shaw finally got his shoes back in February of this year. Many collectors were excited when they heard that Mr. Shaw planned on selling the slippers. Heritage Auctions, the company that sold the slippers, thought they might sell for around $3 million. But in less than a minute, the price rocketed past $3 million. For 15 minutes, the price continued to climb as people offered more and more money. In the end, the slippers sold for $28 million. So far, the name of the buyer has been kept secret, but the buyer will wind up paying even more than that. With taxes and cost of the auction company, the total came to $32.5 million. The slippers set a new record for the highest price paid for a piece of movie history. The previous record came in 2011, when the white dress worn by Marilyn Monroe in the movie The 7-Year Itch sold for $5.52 million. And it says right here, did you know some of the high interest in this auction may have to do with the movie Wicked, which recently came out in theaters? Wicked tells a similar story from the point of view of the Wicked Witch of the West. Dorothy's magic slippers also show up in Wicked, but as in the original book, they are silver. Next article here. On Bigler's World. Let's go to Science News, or as I like to say, Science News Explores. A new frontier awaits, computing with light. Researchers explore optics as a path to next-gen number crunching, says Catherine Hulick, who wrote this article. In the guts of a new type of computer, a bunch of tiny LEDs emit a green glow. Those lights have a job to do. They're performing calculations. Right now, this math is telling the computer how to identify handwritten images or of numbers. This computer is part of a research program at Microsoft. The device is not enclosed in a case, says Hitesh Balani. He says you can actually put your hand inside the computer to block the light. Once he does this, he explains, it doesn't know what problem is solving. Suddenly, instead of naming numbers correctly, the computer spits out random guesses. Then he takes his hand out of the way. Now the streaming light once again calculates correctly. It's really satisfying to see, he says. Balani is a computer scientist at Microsoft Research in Cambridge, England. His job involves developing this machine, an analog optical computer. As its name suggests, it uses light to compute, and being analog means its operations are the opposite of digital. In a digital computer, signals are either one or zero. It's like a light switch that can only turn on or off. An analog signal is more like a dimmer switch. Any light intensity between fully on and fully off is possible. To be clear, light is already an important part of digital computing. Fiber optic cables zip data back and forth between computers as beams of light. But to actually perform calculations, these computers must first convert that light into electricity. Electronic computers are reaching their limits. It's been getting even harder to increase their speed and power. At the same time, new technologies such as artificial intelligence, or AI, require more and more computing power. The demand for this is exploding, says Delaney. These systems also devour more and more energy. The analog optical computer and other new light-based computing technologies might help meet such demands. This tech could also help green AI and other emerging technologies by cutting how much energy they will need. A little light math. Do you wear eyeglasses? If you do, congratulations. You have your very own optical computer. I had no idea. As light from a scene, there it is, it hits those lenses, it morphs. The scene goes from blurry to crisp. No matter what you look at, the glasses do the math to transform the scene. And says Charles Rooks Kroms, he works at the Stanford University in Stanford, California, and at the Massachusetts Institute in Technology. He says, and they're doing it at no energy cost, except the original cost of making the glass and curving it. A lens filter also does simple math with light. A clear filter allows all light through, but the same as multiplying the intensity of the light by one, explains Balani, you will always get the same intensity on the other side. A black filter blocks all light, so it's multiplying by zero. A tinted filter, like a pair of sunglasses, blocks just some of the light. This equates to multiplying the intensity of light by a value between 1 and 0, he explains. You can also add with light. In a smartphone, camera's chip, the intensity of the many light beams falling on the same area combine this brightness that spots the image. Multiplication or addition happen over the entire area of a filter or a camera chip. Many different light beams get altered all at once. Doing simple operations on vast arrays of numbers just happens to be a very important part of AI. But in a digital computer's central processing unit, or the CPU, all these calculations typically happen one by one. That eats up time and energy. An optical computer can more easily multitask this type of math all at once. Note that some specialized electronic chips used in AI, called graphics processing units, or GPUs, and tensor processing units, TPUs, can also do lots of math at once. Super smart lenses. Some new optical computers take the concept of glass or camera lens to the next level. Let's see, who is this guy? Adrogan Ozakan. He's an engineer at the University of California in Los Angeles. His team designs sensors he calls diffractive optical processors. Think of them, he says, as futuristic lenses. Each processor has multiple layers of glass or some other material through which light can pass. Each layer contains many tiny structures. Each alters light differently. And although they can perform complex tasks, these processors require no energy to run. A factory might use one to find defects in the product it is making. Says Ozkan, let's say I am producing some cancer drug. It's important to find any defective drugs so they don't get delivered to patients. Almost all of the drugs will be defect-free, yet factories today use computers to process images of every single batch, scanning for the occasional defect. That wastes time and energy. At the end of the day, you have too much data, Ozkan says. We're buried under data. A smart optical processor could change that. It could trigger a camera to automatically detect defects. Then the factory would need to photograph only the defective drugs. Ozcan's group designed an optical processor for this task. To test whether it might work in a real-world situation, they used square samples of silicon as a stand-in for a product that a factory might produce. Silicon is a semiconductor. That's material found in standard computer chips. Some of these samples would have defects etched into them. The engineers had to figure out what tiny structures to add to the layers of the processor so it would find these defects. To do this, the researchers created a virtual optical processor with random structures in its layers. They also created virtual simulations of pristine silicon squares. They added defects to 20,000 more virtual squares. Next, they used machine learning on a regular computer to train their new virtual processor. They showed it the virtual samples. At first, it could only guess randomly as to whether a defect was there. But after each success or mistake, the thickness of many tiny parts of the processor, altering how much light it would let through, got tweaked to make correct answers more likely in the future. In the end, virtual light shining through defective samples emerged at a different intensity than if it passed through a good sample. Next, the team had to test this design that would also work in the real world. They 3D printed the processor and tested it with a set of 10 real silicon wafers. The team had already etched defects into 9 of these. The processor correctly identified all the defective wafers and ignored the normal one. Ozcan's team reported that success in October 2023. A paper in Nature Communications. The group has also designed optical processors for many other types of tasks. One of their latest has layers that rotate. This could help it encrypt data. Millions of multiplications. Once a smart lens gets 3D printed, its structures won't change, so each new task requires designing a new lens. You may only need to reprint one or two of its many layers, Ozcan notes, but it's not really programmable in the way a typical computer is today. Microsoft's analog optical computer, in contrast, can be reprogrammed, but unlike Ozcan's smart lenses, it can't capture light from an object or scene directly. Instead, it identifies handwritten images from digital image files, which are electronic. A component called a modulator converts these electronic data into light by changing the brightness of the system's green LEDs. Those LEDs now shine onto a chip. It's just like the chip inside an overhead projector that a teacher might use in your classroom. The projector chip brightens or dims each ray of light in order to do the math that was called for its programming. Notes Polani, there are 4 million pixels on the chip. This means that when light is passing through, he says, in theory, you can do 4 million multiplications at once. These are those where millions of multiplications happen again and again. The answer to each math problem feeds back into a system, brightening or dimming the light in new ways. When the calculation is complete, the computer converts the light back into a digital electronic signal, and this becomes the answer to the initial problem. So it's a hybrid optical/digital computer. Light looping through its LEDs in the projector chip can only perform a specific type of calculation. Other types get routed through an electronic part of the computer. This component also works in very differently from the CPU in a regular computer. It processes analog electrical signals, not digital ones. Other companies, too, are working on ways to make hybrid computers that use both digital electronics and optics. Light Matter, that's all one word, based in Mountain View, California, is developing a chip for AI. It incorporates lasers to do light-based multiplications. All other types of calculations would go through typical electronic chips. A Boston-based company, Light Intelligence, that's all one word, too, makes a computer processor called Hummingbird. It uses light to rapidly shuttle data among different electronic components within a processor. Teaching light new tricks. A general-purpose computer that's wholly optical does not yet exist, and there's a good reason. Photons of light are harder to control than the electrons that drive calculations in regular computers. In the guts of a typical digital computer, components manage the flow of electricity. This is sort of like controlling the flow of traffic along roads. Transistors rapidly start and stop electricity or increase its rate of flow. Diodes force electricity to go in just one direction. Most types of computations require such precise traffic control. Photons, however, don't obey the same rules of the road. It's tough to make them start and start or flow in just one direction, notes Jennifer Dionne. She's a materials scientist. There it is at Stanford University. She says, most photons don't like to interact with their environment at all. Controlling photons usually requires bulky materials, such as large magnets. But computer chips are super teeny. Without a way to control what light is doing at these small scales, I think we're going to be stuck in the dark ages of computing, Dionne says. Thankfully, she's an expert in finding new ways to control light. In 2019, her team designed a new type of diode. It's very tiny. Still, it can make light flow in just one direction. Dionne got the material of this diode to act like a magnet. When a photon went through the material, it felt like it was in a magnetic field, she explains, and hence could only go in one direction. Since 2019, her team has been working on materials to switch light's intensity. We have shown that we can switch the light on and off at very fast rates, she says. Her team has combined this with its new diode. Her Ph. student, Hamish Carr Delgado, he now plans to develop this into a product. It likely wouldn't go into an optical computer just yet, but it could be very useful in data centers, Dionne says. There it could help direct data, moving as light, among various electronic computer components. To keep improving computers far into the future, says Dionne, we will need a range of different approaches. Optics is clearly a promising one, but it's far from the only one. There's also quantum computing and computers that mimic how brains operate. Either of those types might include light for part of its operations. For example, the company Psi Quantum, based in Palo Alto, California, has developed a way to do quantum operations with single photons. They have built teeny tiny components that produce and detect single photons, and they have made components that control photons. So far, they've combined tens of thousands of these components onto silicon wafers the size of dinner plates. When you look at one of these wafers under a microscope, some parts look, says the company's co-founder Pete Shadbolt, kind of like alien spaceships. So many new approaches have been emerging. Together, they suggest how light just might transform the future of computing. Okay, next article. Sticking with science news explorers. This one's entitled Wayward Baby Puffins Get Help from a Community-Led Puffling Patrol. The rescued chicks and their parents aid scientists monitoring puffin population. Jenny Krumarin wrote this particular article. When baby Atlantic puffins in Iceland venture out of the cliffside burrows where they had hatched, they look for the light of the moon. It will guide them to make it to the sea, but nearby town lights sometimes confuse them. This leads to many to make wrong turns en route to the ocean. A community-based puffling patrol searches for and rescues such pufflings that have gone astray in town. These chicks and many of the colony's adults are helping scientists who monitor and study birds' largely mysterious lives at sea. The range of Atlantic puffins spans the North Atlantic, from the coast of Canada and the northeastern United States to Greenland and Russia. These birds spend most of their lives at sea. Iceland Houses, the breeding site of the world's largest Atlantic puffin colony, It's on Haimei. Is that Haimei? Haimei? It's a small rocky island, however you pronounce it. Here, adult puffins pair up and spend the summer laying and incubating eggs, then raising a single chick. Nesting pairs of puffins prefer grassy seaside slopes above rocky cliffs, such as the one seen in this harbor above Haimei. Each breeding pair occupies its own burrow. It's as if the cliff were a huge apartment complex. For about 6 weeks, puffin parents care for their babies. They bring sand eels, another small oceanic fish, to the pufflings. They also fend off predators, such as seagulls. The downy fluff around this puffling's neck shows that it is not ready to fledge or fly. It's just too fuzzy. By late August and September, the young pufflings are mature enough to live on their own. Over 4 to 5 weeks, tens of thousands of young birds ready themselves to fledge. To hide from birds of prey, they'll leave their burrows in the dark of night. Their instinct has always been to head for the open ocean. That's where they hunt small fish and grow. To find the ocean, they follow the moon and its reflection off the water. But about 100 years ago, things got complicated. That's when the island's only town, see how you pronounce this, Vestmannaeyjabur, got electricity. Ever since, dazzled by night lights, some baby puffins have taken a wrong turn towards town and away from the ocean. Enter the Puffling Patrol. Equipped with flashlights, cardboard boxes, and gloves, the folks in Haimei head out in the dark during puffling fledge season. Kids, like the ones poking around at this gas station here, they're poking around, with their dad, they search for lost chicks from about 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. On any given night, a dozen or more kids, groups of teens or younger kids with parents and grandparents, scour backyards, parking lots, and rooftops. They search any place where the glow of town competes with moonlight. It also is a great excuse to stay up late. Puffin bones are dense and heavy. This helps them dive beneath the sea surface, but the young birds are inexperienced flyers. When the pufflings end up in town instead of on a cliffside, they have trouble taking flight, and that leaves them vulnerable to predators, such as cats. It also makes them easy for kids to catch. It usually takes just a short chase to grab one of the birds. The kids put them in a cardboard box and take them home. In the wee hours of the morning, people weigh and log their rescued pufflings on the Puffling Patrol website. The only thing to watch out for are the puffling's tiny kitten-like claws. Ooh. Come morning, the patrol takes healthy rescues, pufflings large enough to live at sea, to the cliffs. Some people allow the pufflings to decide on their own when to launch themselves over the edge. From this height, the birds can catch some air as they fly as far as they're able to before landing in water. Other pufflings get a boost. You get a picture of Kim Couples. She's a staff member at the island's Puffin Rescue Center. She's releasing a puffin, tossing it up in the air there. Some rescues, however, need extra care. Pufflings that fell into the harbor may have been dirtied with oil from boats. Their feathers must be cleaned to become waterproof again. Without this help, the birds would not survive in the frigid North Atlantic. Other pufflings may be found injured or underfed. The Puffling Patrol brings these birds to the Puffin Rescue Center for treatment. It's run by Sea Life Trust, a charity that works to protect the world's oceans and the life within. They got a picture here. Two staff members, yet Chris Coates and Talia Schult. They examine an immature puffling that went into town before losing its down. The bird is healthy, but needs to grow its adult feathers before it can survive at sea. Rescued pufflings also help scientists learn more about their species. Ecologist Erper Snare Hansen, he leads a research team at the South Iceland Nature Research Center. His team monitors populations in Iceland's puffin colonies and works with puffin researchers in other countries. His work has turned up evidence that puffins are a tool user. Get a picture here below, research assistant Lucas Canas Hernandez. He puts on a ring on a rescued puffin's leg. The ring is like an ID band. It allows researchers to track the bird's location and age in a database that helps scientists monitor puffin populations over time. Adult puffins develop a brightly colored striped beak and orange feet. Afterward, their appearance won't change as they continue to get older, so someone can only tell the age of a bird that was ringed as a puffin. During the 2024 season, the Puffling Patrol rescued more than 4,200 pufflings. That's slightly more than the human population of Hamay. Hansen's team ringed some 400 of these young birds. Adult puffins spend most of their lives at sea, coming to land only to breed. Above them, this one just caught lunch. There's a puffin coming in with a tiny fish in its beak. During breeding season, Hansen and his team fit adult puffins, I knew I'd get it right, with battery-operated devices. One can be seen on the adult bird above, called loggers. They have a global location sensor, or a GLS. These loggers detect changes in daylight and record when the sun rises and sets. Such data can pinpoint a bird's location within about 110 miles. Finding and observing birds at sea can be nearly impossible, so until GLS loggers became available, scientists knew little about where puffins went once their brief land-based breeding season was over. Since 2014, researchers have been mapping GLS data in a project called SeaTrack. Hamay is shown with a black dot on this particular map. Areas in the pink show where the puffins of the Hamay spend their time at sea, which is all over the place. All over the Atlantic. Such data are helping scientists understand what seabirds do offshore, why there are fewer and fewer of them, and how we might protect them. Sand eels are a puffin's main food source. Although not true eels, these slender fish have an eel-like appearance. Warming temperatures tend to make the fish less abundant off Iceland, Hansen's group has found. So when these sand eels become scarce, puffins must fly farther to find them. And puffins stressed this way often produce fewer chicks, the team report. Another threat these birds face is pollution, including mercury, plastics, and contaminants from shipping. Humans cause many ocean changes that are putting puffins at risk. Bird migration studies can help find sites in the ocean where human activity should be restricted to protect these birds. When puffling season is over, Hamay's seaside cliffs are quiet, puffin burrows are empty, and kids of the Puffling Patrol can catch up on lost sleep and share their favorite picks. This year, three of the rescued pufflings couldn't be released. They wouldn't survive at sea. They now reside in captivity in the Puffin Rescue Center, alongside a rescued, is that a guillemot, and a handful of adult puffins in permanent care. The rest of the puffins of Hamay are now out at sea. Some of the rings and some of the adults now wear new GLS loggers. Adult puffins return to the same colony, even the same burrow, each year. So Iceland's scientists will wait patiently for the birds' return next summer breeding season, and they will briefly trap these adults and download info from their loggers. From these data, they will weave together the story of each wanderer's ocean journey. Next up on Bigler's World, time for kids. Life in Lava Tubes is the name of this article here. Who wrote it? Maya Wehas. She wrote it. Goes like this. Standing in one of Hawaii's caves, you might think it's empty. It's dark and quiet. Not many plants or animals call this place home, but there's a lot of life. Oh, yes. Most of it you just might not notice. There might be patches of gold, silver, tan, or pink on the cave walls. Shine a light on them, and water droplets make the patches appear to shimmer. Those shining splotches of color consist of microbes. Scientists have been studying these microbes. One reason is that some might be similar to life that once lived on Mars, and maybe still does. Under the surface, many of Hawaii's caves are lava tubes. They were formed by volcanic activity. After an eruption, hot lava can flow like a river. Over time, air cools the surface, hardening it into black basalt. But underneath, molten lava may still flow. As it drains away from the basalt, it leaves behind an empty tube or cave. Let's see here. Lava tubes exist on Mars, too. So scientists wonder, do rock-loving microbes also exist there? By studying Hawaiian caves, researchers hope to unlock what life might be like on other worlds. Rebecca Prescott is an astrobiologist at the University of Mississippi, S-I-S-S-I-P-P-I. She said it's a good place to start. She's part of a team of scientists who have been looking at microbes in Hawaiian caves. They found some species that hadn't been seen before. Microbial cities. Cave microbes have their own ways of surviving their environment. Some get energy from eating the rocks. Many of these species are ancient, allowing scientists to understand how microbes lived billions of years ago. Prescott says, "When you walk into a lava cave, it's like you're walking back in time." Scientists now learning how groups of microbes communicate. Microbes grow in communities that form a slimy film on cave walls. The organisms within a community can talk to one another by sending out chemical signals. This may help them tackle tasks together, such as building these slimy cities. Microbes might be important team members on future Mars missions. A one-way trip to the Red Planet could take 8 months. Astronauts might need to grow their own food, but not many plants can grow in the planet's rocky red dirt, and microbes might help. Here on Earth, some microbes break down toxic chemicals in dirt. Others can eat rocks, releasing nutrients to make soil more friendly to plants. Scientists think that microbes can do the same on Mars, helping turn the rocky dirt into rich soils for future Martian gardens to grow. Let's see, let's do another article from Time for Kids. Let's see, I think I read that one. In fact, I probably read the one I just read. My memory's going. Mountain Lion Shift is the name of this article here. Mountain lions in Los Angeles, California, are becoming more nocturnal. That shift helps them keep away from people. This is according to a study published in Biological Conservation last month. Seth Riley is a wildlife ecologist. These mountain lions exist in one of the largest urban areas in the world, he said in a statement. That would not be possible if mountain lions weren't able to adjust to human activity in ways like this. That was a short article. Let's see, what's the word? I don't know whether I read this one or not. If you mindlessly use an electronic device for too long, you might start to experience brain rot. The term is the 2024 word of the year. Oxford University Press revealed its choice on December 2nd. A person is said to suffer from brain rot after looking at too much unimportant content online. It, says Casper Gratwohl in a statement, he's president of Oxford Languages, it is one of the perceived dangers of virtual life. Yes, yes. Let's see, next one here. This one isn't very long either. Sticking with Time for Kids, Faraway Oceans by Lillian Stone. Uranus and Neptune are called ice giants because of their icy cores, but each of these frosty planets may be hiding a deep ocean. Astronomer Burkhard Militzer, he published his research in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences back November 25th. He used a computer simulation to model two planets. The models revealed a surprise. Uranus and Neptune each seem to have a layer of water beneath the clouds in their outer atmosphere. These oceans could be 5,000 miles deep. A NASA mission to Uranus could confirm the presence of the planet's ocean. The mission isn't set yet, but it's on its website. There it is. NASA says such a mission may be a focus of planetary science in the coming years. Let's see what else we got here. Australia logs off. I think I might have done that. I think I want to write this. Hall pass, please. This is a Time for Kid Reporter review by Nate Rue. Nate Rue read Chronicles of a Lizard Nobody and interviewed Patrick Ness, its author. It commands me to read Nate's thoughts below. In Chronicles of a Lizard Nobody, author Patrick Ness introduces us to Zeke, an oversized lizard, and his two best lizard friends, Daniel and Alicia. They're all trying to figure out how to fit in and survive school. They and the other lizards are bussed in from a less wealthy part of town. As lizards, they're at the bottom of the social hierarchy. Principal Wombat assigns Zeke, Daniel, and Alicia to be hall monitors. They believe it's because they're monitor lizards, and hissing at everyone comes naturally to them. The drama begins when, if I can pronounce this, Pelicanarsis, the biggest bully in school, starts taunting the three friends. Meanwhile, Zeke struggles with things happening in his home life and an unusual knee problem. He befriends Miel, an insightful hawk. He also learns the importance of friendship and of letting go of his insecurities. The story has diverse characters. These differences make each character fun and interesting. For example, Zeke is very large and sensitive about his size. Daniel has ADHD and sometimes says inappropriate things. Young people have a real curiosity about disabilities, Ness told me. Kids really want to know about the disability, but once they do, they just accept it and make it a normal part of their lives. Ness says that Daniel's ADHD is just a part of him, like being a lizard is part of him, like being a small lizard is part of him. That's what's interesting to me. Chronicles of a Lizard Nobody is an entertaining story with humor, drama, and a message about accepting differences. I recommend this book to anyone who enjoys reading about school life and friendships. I enjoyed it a lot and hope you do too. Okay, let's go to Dogo News. Got an article in there. WestJet's annual Christmas miracle brings joy to parents. Kavi Dolazio wrote this article. Canada's WestJet Airlines is well known for its annual Christmas miracle. Now in its 12th year, the heartwarming tradition spreads holiday cheer to unsuspecting individuals. Past miracles include delivering care packages to those in need and helping families reunite for the holidays. In 2024, the company focused its efforts, on parents. Earlier this December, families traveling on a WestJet flight from Toronto to Calgary were invited to visit Santa's station before boarding their flight. There, WestJet's famous Blue Santa asked children what they thought their parents and other grown-ups would like for Christmas. The kids enthusiastically shared their ideas for the aptly named Parents' Wishlist Miracle. Suggestions ranged from simple items like an avocado to smartphones, gift cards, and even a trip to Italy. The passengers then settled in for their 4.5-hour flight to Calgary. While they were relaxing on the airplane, WestJet staff in Calgary rushed to stores to gather and wrap all the gifts in time. Upon arrival, the unsuspecting passengers headed to the airport's baggage claim area. Here, they were stunned to see every requested item, including the avocado, waiting for them. The heartwarming video released by the company on December 9, 2024, captures the joy and the surprise of some of the 130 gift recipients. Okay, let's go to, Student News Daily. This is actually from last week, posted on December 16th, the 80th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge. Bum, bum. Let's see, it says here, this is from the U.S. Army Center of Military History. In late 1944, during the wake of the Allied forces' successful D-Day invasion of Normandy, that's in France, it seemed as if the Second World War was all but over. On December 16th, with the onset of winter, the German army launched a counteroffensive that was intended to cut through the Allied forces in a manner that would turn the tide of the war in Hitler's favor. The battle that ensued is known historically as the Battle of the Bulge. The courage and fortitude of the American soldier was tested against great adversity. Nevertheless, the quality of his response ultimately meant the victory of freedom over tyranny. Early on the misty winter morning of December 16, 1944, more than 200,000 German troops and nearly 1,000 tanks launched Adolf Hitler's last bid to reverse the ebb in his fortunes that had begun when Allied troops landed in France on D-Day. Seeking to drive to the coast of the English Channel and split the Allied armies as they had done in May of 1940, the Germans struck in the Ardennes Forest, a 75-mile stretch of the front characterized by dense woods and few roads held by four inexperienced and battle-worn American divisions stationed there for rest and seasoning. Sure, the seasoning part is, after a day of hard fighting, Germans broke through the American front, surrounding most of the infantry division, seizing key crossroads and advancing their spearheads towards the Meuse River, I think that's how you pronounce it, creating the projection that gave the battle its name. Stories spread of the massacre of soldiers and civilians at Malmedy and Stavelot, of paratroopers dropping behind the lines, and of English-speaking German soldiers disguised as Americans, capturing critical bridges, cutting communications lines, and spreading rumors. For those who had lived through 1940, the picture was all too familiar. Belgian townspeople put away their Allied flags and brought out their swastikas. Police in Paris enforced an all-night curfew. British veterans waited nervously to see how the Americans would react to a full-scale German offensive, and British generals quietly acted to safeguard the Meuse River crossings. Even American civilians, who had thought the final victory was near, were sobered by the Nazi onslaught. But this was not 1940. The Supreme Allied Commander, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, rushed reinforcements to hold the shoulders of the German penetration. Within days, Lieutenant General George S. Patton, Jr. had turned his Third Army to the north and was counterattacking against the German flank. But the story of the Battle of the Bulge is, above all, the story of American soldiers. Once isolated and unaware of the overall picture, they did their part to slow the Nazi advance, whether by delaying armored spearheads with obstinate defenses and vital crossroads, moving or burning critical gasoline stocks to keep them from the fuel-hungry German tanks, or coming up with questions on arcane Americana to stump possible Nazi infiltrators. At the critical road junctions of Saint-Vith and Bastogne, American tankers and paratroopers fought off repeated attacks, and when the acting commander of the 101st Airborne Division of Bastogne, Brigadier General Anthony McAuliffe, was summoned by his German adversary to surrender, he simply responded, "Nuts." Not necessarily mixed nuts, I don't know. Within days, Patton's Third Army had relieved Bastogne, and to the north, the 2nd U.S. Armored Division stopped enemy tanks short of the Meuse River on Christmas. Through January, American troops, often wading through deep snowdrifts, attacked the sides of the shrinking bulge until they had restored the front and set the stage for the final drive to victory on January 25th, 1945. Never again would Hitler be able to launch an offensive in the West on such a scale. An admiring British Prime Minister Sir Winston Churchill stated, "This is undoubtedly the greatest American battle of the war and will, I believe, be regarded as an ever-famous American victory." Indeed, in terms of participation and losses, the Battle of the Bulge is arguably the greatest battle in American military history. Okay, let's go to Frontiers for Young Minds. The CRISPR Revolution. Can we change genes for the better? Asks Jennifer A. Doudna, who wrote this article right here. Let's see here. They say what CRISPR stands for. CRISPR. It's a revolution. And here's the story. Living cells contain molecules called DNA, which serve as a detailed instruction manual that tells each cell how to operate. The entire instruction manual is called the organism's genome. Small sets of instructions in the manual, called genes, code for individual proteins that determine the specific functions of each cell, like the ability of muscle cells to contract, and the traits of the organism, like skin and eye color. There is a middleman between the genes and proteins, however, a molecule called RNA that carries the information from DNA to the cellular machinery that makes proteins. Unlike DNA, RNA is found throughout the cell, not just in the nucleus. Tiny organisms called viruses can interfere with this process and cause disease, like the SARS-CoV-2 virus, responsible for COVID-19 pandemic. Viruses infect cells by inserting their genetic material into the cell and then directing the cell to create copies of the virus, which can then spread throughout the organism. Viruses do not infect only people and animals. They can also infect bacteria. However, certain bacteria have a type of immune system that helps them protect themselves against viruses. When a virus infects a bacterial cell, the bacterium keeps a copy of the viral DNA in a special site in its genome called CRISPR, C-R-S-P-R. C-R-I-S-P-R? There it is. This part of the bacterial genome contains between a few to hundreds of pieces of DNA from different viruses separated by repeating pieces of bacterial DNA. These CRISPR pieces act as a memory system, allowing the bacterium to quickly detect that specific viral DNA if it is ever inserted into the bacterium again. Using special proteins called Cas proteins, C-A-S, the bacterium manages to not only detect but also get rid of the foreign viral DNA. I couldn't say that. The combined system of RNA and Cas proteins is called CRISPR-Cas system. CRISPR-Cas9, a powerful technology for gene editing. I first heard about CRISPR around 2006. At that time, it was starting to be understood that CRISPR provides bacteria with immunity against viruses, but scientists did not know how. When I started working with Emmanuel Charpentier, we hypothesized that this mechanism involved a protein that would chop up or cleave the viral DNA. We knew about a protein called Cas9 that was known to operate with the CRISPR system, but its specific function was still unknown. A collaboration began between our two labs, led by two talented students, Yigit Martin Jenik and Christoph Kalinski, to study this mysterious Cas9 protein. We knew that somehow the Cas protein had to find the specific viral DNA. Our theory was that if the Cas protein were attached to a piece of RNA that matched the viral DNA, they might pair up and this system would bring Cas9 to the correct place in the genome. So we combined the Cas protein with the RNA that matched the part of the CRISPR sequence called the CRRNA to see if it would cut up a target DNA sequence that we wanted to alter. But nothing happened. We did not give up. No. Instead, we considered the possibility that a piece might be missing from the puzzle. The answer came in the form of an additional piece of RNA that Emmanuel's lab was working on called tracer RNA. We combined the tracer RNA with CRRNA and the Cas9 protein and repeated the experiment. This time, the complex successfully targeted and cleaved a specific piece of DNA. We discovered that the natural CRISPR-Cas9 system is a dual RNA-guided DNA cutting system, where two different pieces of RNA are required to cut the viral DNA. I hope you're writing this down. Next, we set our sights on simplifying this process. This entailed determining which parts of both the cRNA and the tracer RNA were essential and developing a more streamlined system. We fused the essential parts into one engineered piece of RNA, transforming the system into a single RNA-guided DNA cutting system. This was extremely important because it is much easier to produce one desired piece of RNA in the lab than to reliably combine two different pieces. Additional studies from several research groups helped figure out that the structure of Cas9 protein and further details of the cleavage process was found that when the CRISPR-Cas9 complex arrives at the correct location on the DNA molecule, which is made of two strands wound together, it first separates the strands. Then the RNA protein of the CRISPR sticks to the matching sequence in the DNA. The complex then uses a small molecular scissors to cut both strands of DNA. Once the DNA is cleaved, DNA repair mechanisms are activated in the cell. Scientists can take advantage of CRISPR's ability to target a specific site in the DNA for cleavage and repair to essentially delete, change, or replace any part of the DNA. This is called gene editing or genome editing. After our initial discovery and simplification of the CRISPR-Cas9 system for gene editing, many more systems with different types of Cas protein have been developed, and the field of CRISPR-Cas technology has expanded. Gene editing using CRISPR-Cas systems can be performed in all living cells, including humans, animals, microbes, and plants. This makes it a cross-cutting technology that influences not only basic research, but also the great potential implications in the field of medicine, agriculture, and even climate change. Finally, I think we're getting to it here. CRISPR and human health. CRISPR-based gene editing could benefit human health in several ways, such as to treat diseases. There are more than 7,000 human genetic diseases, which are caused by errors in particular genes and can be passed from parents to children. Genetic diseases include sickle cell anemia, in which the shape of red blood cells is impaired so they cannot carry oxygen properly. Cystic fibrosis, which is usually a production of mucus damages in the lungs, and Huntington's disease, in which a buildup of abnormal protein damages brain cells. If we edit the mutated genes in people with these diseases, we might be able to correct the errors and prevent the diseases. There's already been remarkable success in addressing genetic disorders using CRISPR technology. From treating a patient with sickle cell anemia or an individual with a vision disease called Leber congenital amaurosis, or LCA. It is also possible to use CRISPR to treat diseases that are not inherited, such as AIDS, in which a person's immune system is damaged. AIDS is caused by a virus called HIV, which CRISPR can target to remove the HIV DNA from the patient's cells. Cancer is another important example. CRISPR can be used to improve the ability of the body's immune cells to target and eliminate cancer cells. Another application of CRISPR is to prevent diseases before they emerge, a field of medical practice called preventative medicine. Preventative medicine can, I think I added a syllable there, can curb a great deal of human suffering and conserve valuable resources, such as funding and materials that would otherwise be used to treat diseases. CRISPR could be used to change certain disease-related genes for the better by introducing good mutations that prevent the development of disease in the future. CRISPR-based preventative medicine could be applied, for example, to prevent heart diseases, Alzheimer's disease, and the spread of infectious diseases. CRISPR can be used to diagnose and treat patients quickly by detecting the DNA of viruses like SARS-CoV-2 in patients or animals. Early identification can help doctors take the necessary measures to prevent the disease from spreading, such as early quarantine guidelines. In addition, using CRISPR to eliminate disease-causing organisms from people who are infected could also help stop the spread of infection. CRISPR gene editing might also be used to fight diseases that are spread from animals to humans. For example, some diseases like malaria are passed to humans by mosquitoes. Using CRISPR, scientists can edit the genes of egg and sperm cells in mosquitoes so that their offspring will be unable to infect humans with malaria. This means that it is possible to modify whole populations of mosquitoes to become harmless to humans. This approach is called germline genome editing, and goes beyond editing the genes of just one individual, as we described above. It means that we can use CRISPR to edit genes across many generations of individuals. Other uses of CRISPR. CRISPR-based gene editing technologies can also be used to modify the genes of plants, making crops more nutritious, or altering foods like peanuts to reduce allergens. It is possible to selectively enhance specific traits of crops to improve the amount of food harvested, or to make crop plants more resistant to diseases, insect pests, drought, or extreme temperatures. To manage crop pests directly, we could use CRISPR to edit insects' genes to limit their ability to damage plants. One strategy aims to spread infertility through a pest population so that it would be unable to reproduce. Beyond agriculture, CRISPR technologies can be applied to addressing climate change. One potential direction is engineering organisms such as algae to produce biofuels that could be used to power our homes and cars, or to remove carbon dioxide from the air through absorption. It might also be possible to modify genomes of microbes to direct their interactions with plants such that they would store carbon dioxide instead of releasing it into the air. More work is needed. Significant progress continues to be made in applying CRISPR to many areas, but there is still work to be done to address its limitations. For example, one major issue with current CRISPR technologies involves their delivery, particularly when they are given to humans. It is difficult to make sure that CRISPR-Cas complexes get to the correct cells and not to other cells that were not the target of treatment. To improve delivery, researchers are investigating other known CRISPR systems besides the CRISPR-Cas system. Ethical concerns. CRISPR technology has proven extremely powerful and efficient, and it could change the way we relate to nature and to each other. However, we must always be careful and responsible when dealing with such impactful technologies. Imagine, for example, if we had the power to engineer improved humans with specific traits and capabilities, or to efficiently engineer many of the animals and plants around us. We might dramatically change the course of evolution. Recommendation for young minds. All my life, science has been about discovery and figuring out how to answer questions for which we do not yet have the answers. I always approach scientific questions with a great sense of wonder, as even a seemingly trivial experiment in the lab could produce a new piece of information, one that I am the first person to learn. This act is like peeling an onion, discovering layers upon layers of truth about how our world works. I find that very exciting and satisfying. I came from a very humble background. No one in my family was a scientist. During my childhood and throughout my education, I kept following my curiosity and pursuing what I found interesting, even through challenging times. That is what I advise to the next generation of scientists. You may not know where your curiosity will lead you, but be persistent and follow it anyway. I certainly did not know that my early fascination with CRISPR would become a world-changing technology with implications across all of science. Persistence is key in fear management as well. At one time or another, we all have doubts about whether the things we pursue will work out or whether we might embarrass ourselves in the process. Those fears are perfectly normal. We cannot dismiss them, but we can certainly manage them by finding sources of support and simply going for it. When you find yourself having to make hard decisions or are worried about taking the next step, remember to embrace both the possibility of success and of failure. Your passion will lead you in the right direction. Anyone can find the courage to take that crucial step, even if it's scary. Perhaps you are similarly passionate about answering questions related to the natural world. If that sounds interesting to you, I encourage you to pursue a career in science. Nowadays, young scientists have very powerful tools at their disposal, like CRISPR, that makes our work as scientists very exciting, yet also quite challenging. Our responsibility as a field is to make sure that we use these tools wisely so that our work will have a positive impact on the human condition and on the environment in which we live. And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.